Well, click with me over to Deuteronomy chapter 6, or if you have a Bible, turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 6. We're going to be there this morning. If you're new to C3, we're glad to have you. We have been in the middle of a sermon series that we're calling The Big Story. We're journeying this year through the Bible. We started on January 1 in Genesis chapter 1, and we're going through the entire scriptures, reading the Bible on a reading plan together, and we'll finish in Revelation at the end of this coming year. And we have been using Sunday mornings to sort of highlight and hit some of the big themes as we go through the big story. We're reading this week in the fifth book of the Old Testament, as it's commonly referred to, in the book of Deuteronomy. The book Deuteronomy literally means the law again. And as we have been studying, we're nearing the end of Moses' life. There have been two big human characters that we've seen so far in the scriptures, at least in terms of the number of words that are taken up in the scriptures, that of the story of Abraham and now the story of Moses. And Moses is about to turn the reins of leadership over to a young man named Joshua, and he's come towards the end of his life. And they have been wandering around in the wilderness for 39 years after God gave them the Ten Commandments. And you remember that story, how the people really messed up. And they've wandered around as a punishment for their lack of trust in God. And now they've come to the end of that, basically that end of that 40 years of wandering around in the wilderness. And they're about to go into the land, and Joshua's about to take over. And there are three basic farewell speeches that Moses gives to the people in the book of Deuteronomy. We're going to look at a part of the second one this morning. These are as he turns the reins of leadership over to Joshua. And Deuteronomy is called the law again because Moses largely reminds the people of what they heard 40 years prior when they really messed up. So this is the law again, and it is a reminder to us and should be act as a reminder to us this morning. It's nothing necessarily new. I'm not sure I'm going to say something this morning that's not new, but hopefully I say it in a way and God's Spirit uses it in a way that radically changes who we are and stirs in us new affections for Him. I really have two things I'm going to say this morning, and let me give you those up front and then I'll come back and hit them. But really the aim this morning out of this text is to show you the necessity of affection for God, and then to show you how that affection for God should result in how we think about the next generation, and particularly how we think about our children. That's where we're going to go this morning. So let's start Deuteronomy chapter 6. We're going to read through the first 15 verses of Deuteronomy chapter 6. Now this is the commandment, the statutes and the rules that the Lord your God commanded me to teach you, that you may do them in the land to which you are going over to possess it, that you may fear the Lord your God, you and your son's son, by keeping all these statutes and his commandments, which I command you all the days of your life, and that your days may be long. Hear therefore, O Israel, and be careful to do them, that it may go well with you, and that you may multiply greatly, as the Lord your God, of the God of your fathers, has promised you, in a land flowing with milk and honey. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your might. And these words that I command you today shall be on your heart, and you shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes, and you shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. And when the Lord your God brings you into the land that he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to give you with great and good cities that you did not build, and houses full of good things that you did not fill, and cisterns that you did not dig, and vineyards and olive trees that you did not plant. And when you eat and are full, then take care lest you forget the Lord, who brought you out of the land of Egypt and out of the house of slavery. It is the Lord your God you shall fear. Him you shall serve, and by his name you shall swear. You shall not go after other gods, the gods of the other peoples who are around you. For the Lord your God in your midst is a jealous God, lest the anger of the Lord your God be kindled against you, and he destroy you off the face of the earth. First thing I want to show you from this text this morning, two desires that God has for us, I believe, this morning. He had them for Israel then. He has them for us, his people, today. First one is that God desires your affections to be for him alone. He desires your affections to be for him alone. When you go through the scriptures, it's generally a really bad idea to rank God's commandments as being more or less important than something else. That's generally a really bad idea. It's a really bad idea to take some scripture and say, this thing is more important than something else. This text, though, is an exception to that. Because when Jesus was asked, what is the greatest commandment? He answered the question by telling the man who asked him, Deuteronomy, this verse right here, Deuteronomy 6 and verse 5. This verse is of supreme importance. When Moses tells the people and reminds them that they are to love the Lord their God with all their heart and with all their soul and with all their might, he was giving them the greatest commandment. And without it believing this commandment and adhering to this commandment and obeying this commandment, we have no hope in this world. You can't go to heaven if you don't obey this commandment. Without this commandment, without affection for God, without a heart for God, without a soul for God, without might for God, we are without hope in this world. And that's why Jesus refers to this commandment as the first and greatest commandment, because without it, we can live a really moral life if we believe the rest of the law and obey the rest of the law, but without affection for God at the end of this life, we are lost and without hope. And so Jesus calls this the first and greatest commandment. Now, people look at this oftentimes, and Jesus adds to it heart, soul, and he adds mind. So we could include that here, heart, soul, mind, and strength. The idea is not necessarily to parse each individual word, and some people have tried to do that and tried to narrowly define what each of those words means. What does it mean to love God with your heart? And people will go to emotion or to affections or to desires and motives and try to define what mind means and try to define what strength means and try to define what soul means. And I don't think God gave this in a way that he meant us to narrowly define any one of those. I think what God intended when he said your heart, your soul, your mind, and your strength is, I'm looking for all of who you are to love me. There is no part of you that I don't want you to emanate and to have a heartbeat for a love and affection for me. And we live in a culture where people are kind of okay with spiritual things as long as it's a part of who we are. We have a physical health part that we're interested in. We have a schooling or a work part that we're interested in that we should take care of and do well. We have maybe an intellectual part of us. Maybe it's schooling or other things or advanced degrees that we should be a part of. And hey, we should probably also have a spiritual piece about us so that we're a really well-rounded person. And there is none of that in the scriptures. What God is looking for from us, his people, is a people who are all about him, who are all in about God, who have all of our affections and all of our mind and all of our heart and all of our soul. Everything that we are is for him. And when we begin to stop compartmentalizing our life and think about all of it is his, then we start to understand this command. I think that's what God's driving for in this. I'm looking for a people who have undivided affections for me. I want all of who you are, heart, soul, mind, and strength. You see that a little bit in verse 6 when he says, these words that I command you today shall be on your heart. This is likely a foreshadowing of what God's going to say in Jeremiah 31 when he's going to talk about the new covenant. And he's going to promise in Jeremiah 31 that he will no longer write the law on stone tablets, but now he's going to write them on the hearts of men. And this is a heart command. This is about the affections. You can't do this necessarily by adhering to things externally, but we're dealing with heart matters. We're dealing with affections. And God is saying, I want all of your affections to be for me. I'm looking for all of who you are. And I want this law to be not just merely mental ascension. I'm not looking for intellectual understanding. I'm looking for you to love me with affection. And I want this to be on your heart as much as it is on your mind and on your thought. Even in the Old Covenant, I think it's important to point out that God cares about our affections. And sometimes we can read through the Old Testament and mistake this idea that the New Testament is about feeling and emotion, and the Old Testament was about cold adherence and obedience. And this passage stands in stark contrast to that, to say that God desires from his people from the beginning to have affections for him. And that as we think about, even in the New Testament, as we're commanded various things, that even in obedience to those commands, we cannot miss the idea that there must be affection for God in the midst of them. Or we are no different than any other religion that tries to live a moral life. In the midst of all of my obedience, there has to be affection for God, or it accomplishes absolutely nothing. I think David captures this beautifully in Psalm 63 when he says, I am thirsty for you, God. That's a crazy way to think. Could we say that about ourselves? God, I'm thirsty for you. I'm not just trying to live obedient life. I'm not just trying to be moral. I'm not just trying to raise my kids well. But God, I'm thirsty for you. I'm parched. I'm famished. I'm thirsty for you. He goes on to say, your love is better than life. These are words of deep affection for God. To say to God, your love is better than life. I would trade my life for your love. Those are words of deep affection. Now, the reality is for most of us in the room, we've been around church for a long time. So to say to you, love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength is not new. I mean, maybe for a few in here this morning, this is a radical concept. You had no idea that God wanted that from you. And if so, I pray that God's Spirit would change your heart this morning and stir affection for him in a new and a fresh way. But for most of us in the room, to say to you that God desires your undivided affection, you've heard that a lot. And the reality is for you and for me is there are places in our lives where we need that to be not just heard, but to be done in a new way. And so the question is, how do you stir affections for God in places of your heart and of your life and of my heart and my life where we don't have affection for him? Where maybe we're doing the right thing, but we're just doing the right thing and there's no affection for God. So what do we do about that? Well, I'm glad you asked. Moses goes right there, I think, in this text. And I see five means by which Moses gives to the people in this text ways to stir new and fresh affections for him. And maybe one of these five will hit home with you this morning. The first one I see is that we're to think on his word. These are the practical means by which God intends to stir new and fresh affections for him. And one of those, the first one here, A, there in your outline, is that we are to think often on his word. Look at verse 8 and 9. He says, you shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes, and you shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. Now, you've probably seen pictures of Jews who have literally taken this command, literally, and created these little boxes on their hands or boxes on their heads, and inside those are scriptures so that their scriptures are always before their eyes or on their hands or near their hands. And I would say to you this morning that God is not interested in a display. That's not what he's talking about here. And the modern Christian bookstore, you walk in there, and they got t-shirts and hats and bracelets and all the cheesy pictures and all this Christian potpourri, and there's like 3,000 square feet of like stuff before you even get to like anything that you could read or listen to. You know what I'm talking about? And you say, should we take all of that stuff home and plaster it everywhere? And should I wear all of it all of the time? There's nothing wrong with wearing that or posting that. But wearing it and posting it is not what God is talking about here. The reason why I think God says, I want you to put it on your hands is because everything you do, I want you to think it through the lens of what I have commanded you. Everything you do with your hands, I want you to think about it. Everything, putting it between your eyes, everything you look at, everything you think about, the lens through which you look at all of life, I want that lens to be through the lens of Scripture. Through the lens of what I've commanded you. This is what he's looking for, not merely a display, but a people who are thoughtful about what he has commanded and what he has said, and to do all of life through that perspective. And then he says to put it on your doorposts and on your doors. I think the implication there is you're going to constantly walk through the door of your house. You leave it in the morning, you come back in the afternoon if you go away and work. Some of you, many of you in the stage of life, go in and out of the house more often than that. The idea is wherever you are, constantly be reminded about the truth of his word. And the reality is that without thinking about his word, new and fresh affections aren't stirred. I love the reading plan that we're doing as we're reading through the Old Testament currently in the book of Deuteronomy. We're also reading one psalm a day. The Psalms are a terrific place to stir new and fresh affections for Jesus and for God. Just pray the Psalm. I'm going to do it at the end of the sermon. I'm going to pray Psalm 139 over us. but we're just going to pray it. And I would encourage you in that way. The psalmist says things that are true about God, and to think on the psalms as we're going through them is an opportunity for worship. It's an opportunity to turn your eyes towards the things of God and to say things that are true about him. And in saying those things and considering those things, they stir new affections in our hearts and in our lives for who he is and what he has done and what he will do. The second practical means I think God intends to stir new affections for him is that he warns us in verses 10 through 13, don't love your stuff. Don't love your stuff. In verse 10, it says, when the Lord your God brings you into the land, he swore to your fathers, Jacob and Isaac and Abraham, with good and great cities that you did not build and houses full of good things you didn't fill and cisterns you didn't dig and vineyards and olive trees that you didn't plant. Affection for God is quickly robbed by a love of possessions. And when Paul is talking to young Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 17, he's counseling this young pastor about how to love his people well and how to shepherd them well. He tells that young pastor, Timothy, he says, you tell the people, don't set their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but set your hope on God. God gives us lots of great things to enjoy, which is the end of 1 Timothy 6:17. He has richly provided us everything to enjoy. And these people that God is pushing into the promised land, they are going to get all kinds of great stuff. All kinds of good and great cities. All kinds of homes filled up. They moved into fully furnished homes, is what God's saying. I'm going to give you a fully furnished home. You're going to open up the cabinet and all the dishes are going to be there. You're going to go in the living room and it's going to be completely set up. And when you have all of that stuff, I want you to remember the giver and not the gift. I want your mind and your heart to remember that I did the giving here. You didn't get it. You didn't earn it. You didn't dig it. You didn't build it. It's a gracious gift of my hand. The reality for us is that when we love our stuff, it turns our affections away from him, and turning our minds, even in the midst of having things, back to saying, everything I have, God, is from you. And if you want it back, you can have it back. If you need it for a kingdom purpose, take it, God. Everything I have is loosely held because it's from him and it is for him. And my affections get robbed for Jesus when my affections turn to loving my stuff. Third thing, practice obedience. Verse 17 and 18, I got to go quickly. 17 and 18, he says, you shall diligently keep the commandments of the Lord your God and testimonies. When he says in verse 17, diligently keep, and in verse 18, do what is right and good, God's aim for our affections, and disobedience, it's like pouring water on a fire. That's what disobedience does. And some of you this morning may be in a place where you just feel like, I'm trying to do the right thing, but I have so little true affection and love for God. Like, I'm not even anywhere close to the all part of this. Don't be tempted to say obedience doesn't matter because I have no affection for God. In the midst of struggling, obey and pray that God will change your heart and bring the affection with it. I think there's a danger that we would say, God, I just don't feel like it, so I'm not going to do it. And this text is saying, no. In the midst of a lack of affection, continue to practice obedience. Hebrews chapter 5 says that the mature lover of God is a person who constantly practices discerning right from wrong. And a lack of affection for him is no excuse for ignoring his commands. And so practice obedience and pray in the midst of your practicing obedience that it doesn't become cold-hearted obedience, but that God brings affection in the midst of it. Fourth thing is reflect on his salvation. I'm going to come back to this in just a second, but in verses 21 through 23, he talks about when your son comes to you and asks you about the law, like, why are you talking about this all of the time? Their answer that God says you're to give to our kids is that we were Pharaoh's slaves in Egypt, in verse 21. And the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand, and the Lord showed us signs and wonders, great and grievous, against Egypt and against Pharaoh and all his household. The idea is that we would remember often, reflect often on what he has done for us. These are seeds of affection for him to be reminded of how desperate a condition we were in without him. God, I need you. I'm without hope in this world. And if you had not saved me, I would be nothing. And in reminding myself of his salvation and what he has done on the cross for me, it stirs again fresh affections for him. Fifth thing I see here in this text in verse 24 is that we are to trust in the promise of his reward. Trust in the promise of his reward. The Lord commanded us in verse 24, commanded us to do all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God for our good always, that he might preserve us alive as we are to this day. Do you see all of God's commands as for your good? That's the question. And the perspective of a person who is stirring new and fresh affections for God looks at the commands and practices obedience, and in the midst of practicing obedience says, God, you did this for my good. It may not be what I want to do. At the moment, it may not be what I would have chosen to do. But God, I know the path of obedience, though I don't see it in the moment, this path of obedience, it is done for my good. I love Psalms 56. We read it this week. I think it was on Tuesday. The promise there that God is at work in all things. And literally it says in Psalms 56 that God is for us. And I would just say to you, in the midst of practicing obedience, remind yourself often that I am doing this because God is for me. This is why he's commanded this, because God is for me, and he is at work in all things, working all things together for the good of those who loved him. So we trust in that promise. It's not here in Deuteronomy chapter 6, but I feel like I can't leave this without saying, if you don't have affection for God, or you feel like there are places in your heart and life where you are lacking affection, pray for affection. Pray for it. God, stir new affections for you in my heart and in my life. Okay, so point number two. Point number two is that we should be constantly teaching our children affection for him. God desires that we constantly teach our children affection for him. It jumps off of this page in this text, in this chapter. In verse 2, he says that you would fear the Lord your God, you and your son and your son's son. In verse 7, he says, right after saying, love me with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, he says to them, you shall teach them diligently to your children. And then in verse 20, when your son asks you in time, what is the meaning of the testimonies and statutes, you shall say to your son. The idea here is a big picture theme throughout all of Scripture, that we are to transfer the knowledge of God from our generation to the next generation. And if we put it in the big picture, the big story that we're talking about, you remember in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 27, you know the very first command that God gave to Adam and to Eve? He told them to be fruitful, to multiply, and to fill the earth. And then the flood comes, and then everybody on earth is destroyed except for Noah and his sons and their wives. And they come out of the ark, and you know what God says to them? He blesses them, and then he tells them to be fruitful, to multiply, and to fill the earth. And the question is God primarily talking about procreation? Is he just saying, let's make a whole lot of people on the earth? And we get to Deuteronomy 6, and it becomes really clear that when our understanding of Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 9, when God says be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, is that God isn't just talking about creating humans. He's talking about creating worshipers of him. And his aim to us as parents and to us as a church is that we would be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth with people who have affection for God. And that's what this text is all about. And it's why he goes right from love me with heart, soul, mind, and strength right into teach this to your children. Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth with worshipers. If I had more time, and I don't, I would go right to adoption in this and just say, this is why God is so concerned about orphans in the world. The intention, the God-designed intention, is that parents would teach their children about the greatness of God. And orphans in the world don't have a parental figure to teach them about the greatness of God. And so he calls the church to go and be fruitful and multiply, lovers of him, and care for orphans. Because the God-designed primary way of doing that is through the home, and it's not there for orphans. But we'll save that for another day. All right, so you think for just a second about this command. And it comes up in John chapter 21 after Jesus' resurrection and his death, and he's on the beach with Peter. And they're hanging out there, and Jesus is about to send Peter out to start the early church. And you think about what's happened in Peter's life. He's very, very recently denied Christ 3 times. Very recently. Judas went and hung himself and died. Now Peter's on the beach with Jesus, and Jesus looks at him and says, Peter, do you love me? Peter says, I love you. And Jesus says, feed my sheep. And Jesus says to him a second time, Peter, do you love me? Peter says, you know, I love you. Jesus says, tend to my sheep or feed my sheep. Jesus looks at Peter a third time and says, Peter, do you love me? Peter responds, I love you. You know all things. You know that I love you. And the implication, at least one of the clear implications of that text, when Jesus says to Peter three times, feed my sheep, is that he doesn't require perfection from us to teach people to love him. But he does require someone to love him. And as parents, and I'm talking primarily to parents this morning about this point, the primary need your children have is for you to love God with heart, soul, mind, and strength. He does not need you to be perfect. Your kids do not need you to be perfect. My kids, and they know I'm not perfect, so this is like a farce, but they don't need me to be perfect, and thank goodness, because I'm not. But they do need me to love God. And Jesus, I think, would say to us this morning, if, as a parent, hey, if you love God, then feed my sheep, teach the children. Notice what he says there in verse 7. He says, I want you to teach your children diligently. He uses these words to say, when you talk of them, when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise. We are always doing one of those four things. We are either sitting or moving. We are either lying down or we are up. And he's saying, as in the same way that he's saying, I want all of you, he's saying, I want you to do this all the time. There should not be times in our lives when we are not about teaching our children affection for God. I feel like I'm standing on a razor's edge to talk about this stuff. We should talk about it so often. And in verse 20, he acknowledges that our kids are going to say to this, why are we always talking about God in this house? That's basically what verse 20 is saying. When your kids come to you and are like, what is the deal with all this God talk? It says, remind them of the salvation that has come. But there's a razor's edge as a parent about this. And I just want to press into this and make sure you don't hear me saying either one of these two things to the exclusion of the other. On the one hand, we are not saying, and I am not saying this morning, that reading the word and prayer and memorizing scripture is unimportant. Because all we should be doing is pouring into our kids' affection for him. And so until my kids have affection for him, well, I'm not going to make them memorize scripture, and we're not going to pray together, and we're not going to read the word. I think that is a dangerous place, as we just came from. Those are the means by which God uses to fuel affections for him. And so while our kids maybe don't express and show affection for him yet, we are pouring into them propositional truth that ultimately can fuel a fire for affection for him and prepare them for service and prepare them to be a lover of God and prepare them to be a worshiper. On the flip side of that, I'm saying as parents, if all we are doing is teaching our kids to memorize and we are teaching them to pray and we're teaching them to read the word and they see us do that in a cold and calculated way that has no affection for him, we are raising little Pharisees. And Jesus would say about our kids, if we raise them in that way, these people, they honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. And God forbid we parent that way. It's both. It's both teaching them propositional truth, teaching them the word, praying with them, memorizing the scripture, and saying, your heart matters. Affection matters. A heartbeat and a passion, all of who you are, has to beat for the presence and the glory and the beauty and the treasure that is Jesus. It is both, not one or the other. Our kids have to come to the place where they gather together and get on their faces before God and say, God, I love you. I'm not just doing the stuff, but I have affection for you. And as parents, we have to pour into them the means by which they do that, to have affection for them. Okay, let me wrap up and just give you a couple other applications here real quickly. Some of you in the room, maybe you're single and you'd say, you're talking a lot about what it means to have, to teach kids and to parent kids and to raise up worshipers of God. What if I'm single? Let your desire, I would say in this, let your desire for a spouse be modified into thinking and looking for a worship teacher. Let your desire for a spouse not simply be based on how big their muscles are, or how good they look. Charm is deceitful and beauty is vain. But let your heart be modified and your desire be modified to say, God, grant me to have a worship teacher in my home so that as we raise our kids together, we teach our kids to have affections for God and teach them truth. If you're a young married and you don't have kids, maybe you really want kids, and maybe some of you this morning are in that really hard time of life. Ashley and I were there early in our marriage where we really wanted kids, and it just wasn't happening. We got over that problem, as you can see. But we were at a stage in life where we really wanted kids and it wasn't happening. Use these days to let God modify maybe your desires to simply have kids and pray for worshipers. Don't just pray that God would give you somebody who looks like you, who talks like you, who's fun to have around, but God grant, this is your prayer, God grant to me a child who is a worshiper and a lover of you. Empty nesters, last group I'll talk about. Maybe your kids are out of the home and you're at that place a little older in life and there are a number of you in our church. And let me just say and encourage you this morning that your potential to impact the next generation, it's not over. It's not over. And I can tell you as a parent of young kids, we need your encouragement. We need you to encourage us that our labor is not in vain. That pouring truth into our kids is not a wasted effort. That it is a process that takes a long time. And that one conversation isn't going to solve it in our homes. Because believe me, we've had the conversation in my home more than once. And I don't think it's that I'm an ineffective communicator with my kids. I think it's a process, just like in my life with my kids, a process of having affection for God. And sometimes that process, being really honest, is super discouraging. Anybody with me? Parents in the room? That is a super discouraging process. And so you empty nesters could come alongside us and cheer for us and say, keep it up. This is a worthwhile, eternal effort. It would also be really cool if some of you empty nesters came and served in C3 Kids with us. Man, it'd be great for our kids to see that loving God is a lifelong effort. It's not just something you do when you have young kids, you take them to church. Wow, do we love God with our whole heart? And in the midst of loving him with our whole heart, he says, go and teach that affection to our children.